A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You know, I get a bit melancholy sometimes and I worry about how long I've got left and everything.
Yes, death maths.
Well, this morning I was really jolly. I'd done my bit of yoga. I was perky. I was thinking, I've got this. I feel great. And then I thought I'll just pick up that stuff that's just been popped through my door. And normally I don't take things personally, but I've taken this a bit personally.
Go on. Well, is it a mobility scooter?
In my door, I've been given a leaflet and I thought it said, a cruelty-free dining experience. And I thought, that's interesting. I'm all for cruelty-free, vegetarian. Mm. You're on my wavelength. Bespoke post. No, it says cutlery-free dining experience.
What?
It says, join us. I took this really personally. Yeah. Join us to sample cutlery-free dining choices. This is for residents who find manipulating cutlery for various reasons.
Oh.
A barrier to enabling them
it's
to eat independently.
Home.
Yes, Trish.
Oh,
now,
right.
I know the time will come, and I know which one will look after me. I think it might be the older one. Number two just have me thrown on the street,
right.
I think. I know
yes.
The time will come, but I did take it really, and then I went from up to down.
To down.
Trish,
oh, dear.
My cutlery-free dining.
Well, you see, I think that you already do quite a lot of cutlery-free dining. What with your hobnobs, your Marmite on toast, and lumps of cheese. So you don't need cutlery for any of that. So you're already halfway there.
Maybe it's a trend. Maybe it's actually a new modern trend.
Yes.
Younger people, cutlery-free dining. Oh, I might start that as a business.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Lorraine Candy.
And I'm Trish Halpin. If you're living in a hormonal hothouse, feeling a bit overwhelmed and in need of some positive, uplifting and comforting guidance on how to lead a more magnificent midlife, then this is the show for you.
We chat to celebrities and experts on all things midlife, from menopause and perimenopause to parenting teens, via fashion, beauty, wellness, nutrition, fitness, careers, relationships, caring for elderly relatives and your finances.
Yes, we ask experts and famous guests all the questions you need answered to have a happier, healthier and more harmonious second act. Right, I'm going to turn this week's show upside down and start with the nostalgia noodle because I've had a strange turn of events that I need to fill you in on. It's also a bit of a name drop too.
Don't tell me you've gone back in time and you've remembered.
Yes.
That you, it wasn't Courtney Cox that was pulled on stage for Bruce Springsteen. It was you. You've had a flashback,
yes.
Haven't you?
Yes, exactly.
Have you remembered that you were once the fifth member of Brotherhood of Man? Do you remember that? I was singing that the other
Kisses
day.
This is for me. Yes, I've had a random false memory syndrome. No, it's none of that. I mean, I know the celebrity stakes are very high with you, but I think this one might make you chuckle because it's actually to do with my Tottenham Hotspur cushion. The cushion has made another appearance on the podcast.
Basically, as apart from Margot as the other star of the podcast, I am intrigued. So I'm going to explain to anyone who may not have listened to 10,000 episodes of Postcards from Midlife. Trish, in one of our nostalgia noodles, Trish talked about how she embroidered the Tottenham Hotspur logo onto a cushion for her O-level needlework classes. And for those of you who don't know what the logo is, it's a cock on a ball.
Yep.
How is that relevant to what we're talking about today?
Let me tell you. Are you sitting comfortably?
I am excited.
It's sort of a slightly long story. Can you cope with that?
Is it like one of Ronnie Corbett's monologues? I've got my tea. I've got my hobnobs. I'm gripping the side of my chair, Trish.
And your big old person's armchair. That's good. Right. Well, listen, it started...
Free dining experience in front of
you. Yes, exactly. It started with yet another one of those random emails that we get in our inbox. And I was invited, me, not you, can I just say.
I don't know why.
Exactly. Normally it's both of us. Yeah, well, exactly. But I was invited by this health tech company called Boira to speak to Tottenham legend and former England manager Glenn Hoddle. Now, he was in the FA Cup winning side that I made the cushion in honour of, because I went to that game way back in the 80s at the long ago original Wembley Stadium.
Shut the front door, Trish, as my teenagers would say. You went to the game.
I went to the game, yes.
So many secrets, Trish, you keep from me. You're not making it up, are you? It's not one of your dreams, one of them funny fantasies that you have. Glenn Hoddle, elastic pants, cock on a ball, Tottenham Hotspur fantasies.
Oh my God. Well, I may have had a slight crush on Mr. Hoddle back in the day.
That's inexplicable. Completely inexplicable.
Well, I don't know. I don't think so, because I think you and I could have gone on a double date with him and Chris Waddle. Because do you remember that? Hoddle and Waddle. They had a top 40 hit. Do you remember it? Do you know what it was called?
No, go on.
It was called, I'm going to get this wrong, it was either Diamond Lights or Diamond Nights. I can't remember it, so I can't sing it for you. Exactly.
I do remember they had mullets, didn't they?
Yes,
on the Top of the Pops
did.
Thing. Anyway, back to Glenn. Glenn and you, health email. What happened next?
This is what happened next. So, unfortunately, Glenn, poor old Glenn, had a cardiac arrest a couple of years ago in a TV studio when he was commentating on some football game. And his life was actually saved by a sound engineer who gave him CPR. And he's sort of, since then, he's been a campaigner for heart health and getting people to learn how to do CPR ever since. So I got to have a chat with him because he was promoting something called the Life Pad, which Boira makes. And they do kind of blood pressure monitors and all those kind of useful things that as we get older, we should definitely have in our houses.
Not cutlery,
and it's
though.
This,
no cutlery
not
in our houses.
No, exactly. No technological cutlery.
Yeah.
But it's this sort of small mat that you can roll up. Actually, you can literally keep it in your handbag or in the car or wherever. So that if you were in a situation where someone had a cardiac arrest, you place it on their chest and switch it on. And it shows you where to put your hands. It tells you how hard to press, how frequent to press, etc., etc. So if you don't have a clue how to do CPR, like me, I do keep meaning to go on a course. That could be something that's really useful. It costs about £60. You can get it in Argos, in fact.
Wow, interesting fact. I do know how to do CPR.
You do?
I went along because as a young person and a teenager, my dad had 4 heart attacks.
Oh, gosh.
So throughout my childhood, we were kind of... And so it was always forefront of my mind. And when the kids were born, I thought, you know, you get a bit obsessive about their health and babies and things.
Yes,
and I thought, what happens if I have to, you know, revive baby at any point? So I went and did a couple of courses. So that is a skill I
would
have.
would you still remember?
Well, I think I know where to put my hands. I think it was I can do it on a very small baby as well, just
Okay.
Those 4 fingers below, two things below the chest. Anyway, so what's that got to do with the cushion and Glenn? We've gone off. We've veered right off.
I know. It's a shaggy dog story, isn't it? So, well,
did you tell him about the cushion?
Not only did I tell him about it, I showed it to him.
You had an audience with Glenn Hoddle.
I had a Zoom audience with Glenn, so I could see him in his bedroom during these interviews. Anyway, I showed him the cushion.
He must have done about 4 in a row.
Exactly.
And then thought, hold on a minute, it's a super fan.
It's a super fan with a cushion. And it took him sort of a moment, split second, to think, what the hell is she sort of shoving in the camera here? And then he got it and he loved it. Made Glenn Hoddle laugh. And would you like to hear what he said? Because we've got a little clip. I recorded it.
Excellent. I'll tell you what, that is very close to the new cockerel on the shirt, which changed a few years back, if you noticed.
Ah, right.
There's a cockerel out there now that is simplified, actually. It resembles your cockerel there. Well done. You're ahead of your time.
So there we have it. Glenn Hoddle says, I am ahead of the times. He loved my design, my logo, my cock on a ball.
I'm looking at the cushion now.
Holding
so
it
I don't know
you.
Where you go with this huge success, whether you go down the crafting route,
yes.
Take that up, or whether you just do an audience with old heroes from the 80s,
yes.
Old footballing heroes. Is that your new thing, maybe?
Well, it's like a dream come true. I mean, if you told 14-year-old me that one day I would interview Glenn Hoddle and he would admire my needlework, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that, does it?
Well, it's inexplicable, Trish. I don't think anyone would have been able to. None of it makes any sense at all. It's just like a dream, isn't it? Anyway, let's get on with the show because we've got another bit of a teen dream scenario coming up. Doesn't involve needlework. We are going to get to be Kathy and Claire. And after we solve some of our midlife dilemmas, we're going to be talking to a special guest this week, the groundbreaking comedian, campaigner and midlife mum of three, Angie Lamar. And she's going to be talking to us from Jamaica, Trish.
Oh, that is so exciting. And as we're about to unleash our problem-solving words of wisdom, we should probably give a warning, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Everything comes with a warning, Trish, for us, doesn't it? Don't take it seriously and don't sue us.
God, yes, absolutely. We should give a warning that our alter egos, Marion and Millie, will also be sharing their pennies worth, which might not be...
No.
The kindest
I'm going to explain
things.
Marion and Millie again. Marion, based on someone who once emailed us and told us to stop talking drivel, is a kind of prudish, passive-aggressive Marion. Yes. And Millie is a confused, furious, feminist militant.
Yes, slightly elements of our own personalities between the two of them.
Anyway, we have three pivotal questions. Let's find out what they are and what we think about them.
Right, agony aunts at the ready. We have three problems to solve this week, Lorraine. I'll kick off by reading the first one and you tell me your thoughts. All names have been changed for confidentiality. And as usual, I have selected the names on a theme and you have to guess the link, Lorraine.
It's always a quiz, isn't it? Come on, fire away.
Quizzes.
We're about to do good work for people.
Okay, right. This first one is from Virginia, who says, I've been married for more than 20 years and on the whole would say we have a strong and happy relationship and we have built a great life together. However, there is one thing that has always bugged me about my husband, which I think is getting worse. He just doesn't listen to me. He never remembers where I'm going, what I'm doing, or if I have a big presentation at work, even though I always tell him either at the beginning of the week or in the morning before I leave the house. I find it hurtful that he doesn't ask me specifically about those things. He might ask how my day's been, but always after I ask him how his has been, but he won't remember the specifics. Sometimes I wonder if he even notices I'm there. I did an experiment last weekend by letting him talk for 20 minutes about the latest SAS book he's reading and deliberately didn't ask any questions or join in, but he just kept going without asking me my thoughts or opinions. And frankly, obviously, I'm not interested in that. How do I get him to pay more attention to me and be more interested in what is going on in my life? What say you, Lorraine Candy?
Caveat this with the fact that we've interviewed a lot of therapists, haven't we, Trish? We've written a lot of things. So this is not off the top of our head advice. But we've got a midlife audience there, Gen X. Gen X men, sadly, aren't big listeners. They are big interrupters and they are big talkers. But this is not always their fault. So we know that is the context. I would ask our lovely Virginia, I think I've got the theme of the names. I would ask our lovely Virginia to think about it from his point of view. I know that might not be her immediate thought because she's obviously quite cross, but he may be fearful of what he's going to say. He may be fearful of getting it wrong. He may be fearful of not understanding. And he may be fearful you are cross with him because I think that sometimes happens. Certainly, well, when Mr. Candy had a hearing, one of those annual hearing tests, he came back gleefully saying, look, I'm not deaf, I'm not deaf. And I said, well, that's not good news. You're just not listening then, are you? Anyway, it's very hard for men of that generation, I am generalising, to feel vulnerable. But you obviously feel quite vulnerable. Not being heard is really a central part of someone's identity. And we always talk about it with teenagers. You know, if you're not being heard, you feel invisible. It does create quite a sadness around you. Perhaps at the beginning of the conversation, when you want him to listen, you could ask more directly rather than just expecting him to listen. And you could say, I'm telling you this because I just want to be heard. I'm telling you this because I want you to advise me or I want you to fix this. I'm telling you this because it's important to me. Can you listen and make time to listen? So I think it's a kind of feminine energy in a way to ask that. And I think he may be in that place where he is a little bit confused and his nervous system immediately goes to, I don't know what's happening. What is she offering me here? what do I need to do? So I think you need to set the scene up when you want him to listen to you. And it's like that thing we talk about a lot, Trish, isn't it? Habits, getting into habits of, you know, you can start with, you know, very small conversations and kind of that like more of a closeness, because poor Virginia is obviously really, really cross with him. So she's obviously possibly coming into that conversation in quite a defensive stance. And anyone, any male is going to be immediately defensive back, and all their kind of understanding, cognitive skills will just stop immediately because they're just getting through that.
Yeah.
Perhaps he might just be ignoring you because that's his habit, and perhaps you need to point it out in a more forceful way and ask him what's going on, but really listen to him as well. And I think all these little things of, you know, we've said before, getting closer to him physically, being kind, adding some laughter into life. Are you listening to him, or are you quite cross when he starts talking about things like his SAS book? So you know, he might not feel listened to as well. So that's where my upbeat therapy voice comes from.
Yes. Okay. So shall I add my
add your therapy thoughts,
just to add in, and before we get on to the two
4 million Marion step in.
Yes, exactly. Right. So no, I totally agree, because it's about communication, isn't it? And it sounds like she says he's always been like this, but this is really annoying her. So it sounds like it's probably been building, and there's been some resentment, which means there hasn't been some proper communication going on for a while. So clearly they have a good relationship. She's very happy. But maybe they just need to put a bit of the spotlight in life onto the relationship and onto their communication. And also, it's so easy to get into kind of just rubbing along and getting through the day and all of that. But we don't show our appreciation for each other, I think, a lot of the time. So, yeah. So it's, how do you appreciate each other? And in terms of the SAS book, I mean, I have to confess, I often switch off when Neil is going on about World War II book or engines.
I'm a bit Millie. I just say that I'm really not interested in, I won't be able to add to your thoughts on this. So please take it somewhere else.
Well, sometimes I just sort of switch off and let him carry on, and he doesn't. And sometimes I actually ask some questions and find myself quite interested in what he's got to say. So is that, you know, are you showing an interest in each other's sort of interests and passions, I would say.
Well, also when you ask is really important as well, because sometimes my husband will be telling me a great long story while I'm doing something else. And that was fine when I was in my early 40s. Now I can only do one thing at a time. So if he's talking to you, or if perhaps she's talking to him while he's doing something else, or engaged in something else, it's quite hard. Mm. I always think it's worth looking at our own place in what really, really annoys us, because often what really annoys us about someone else is what annoys us about us as well, isn't it?
And it's asking for what you want, not what you don't want. Because if you say what you don't want, that sounds like complaining, doesn't
argumentative
it? So it's trying to kind of, reframe it.
Tell me, what would Marion say?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think Marion's quite pleased with Virginia's passive-aggressive, you know, not talking during the SAS. She's like very on board with that. And she suggests that you should talk him through all the details of this week's Postcards from Midlife episode and see what he has to say about that. But I think her most extreme would say, dump him and find somebody else who is a true mind reader. Is Paul McKenna available? Because that's what we all want, right? A mind reader.
Millie's throwing some figures at him, because Millie knows from surveys that men stop listening after 6 minutes, apparently. They tune out. She also knows that men are 33% more likely to interrupt women. So Millie says, get a great big megaphone, stand by his ear, tell him those figures. Say this is from the No Shit Sherlock list of surveys about men interrupting, talking over women, etc. And say that if he doesn't listen next time, she's going to run off with a personal trainer who's 25 years younger.
Yeah, that's it. That's the answer.
That's what Millie says, even though that's against her feminist background. The personal trainer could be male or female, doesn't care. She's out the door.
Right. Next. Come on, let's move it on. Move it on.
So this is a teenager's pairing. It's from Marjorie. Let's work out the theme. We've had Virginia.
Yes.
It's Marjorie.
Should we leave it to the end?
Yes.
We'll leave it to the end.
My 19-year-old daughter is a student and has had a weekend job for the last 6 months. In that time, she has called in sick 3 times. I'm not always convinced that illness is genuine, so I find it really hard to be sympathetic. I've always been a go-to-work, unless your head has fallen off type of person. That's so Gen X, isn't it? Today is her 3rd call-in, and she says she has terrible stomach pains. I've basically ranted at her about toughening up and how she'll end up losing this job if she doesn't show some consistency. How do I deal with this? Sometimes I feel I'm being too harsh, but it's really annoying for me to watch. And on top of that, my partner is moaning about how it will look to her employer, which obviously I know. Any thoughts? What do you think, Trish?
Oh, dear. Marjorie. Well, Marjorie, your daughter is 19, so technically she's an adult. So
not really a child, is it?
It's not a child. I mean, I could sum it up with saying, I just think you need to leave her to it. Yeah. But she's obviously, to your credit, she's obviously had good, diligent, hardworking role models in you and your husband in terms of work ethic. So you've set the groundwork right. You've role modeled for her. But, you know, did it benefit our generation to go in with our limbs falling off?
No, Trish, it did not.
Oh, God, exactly. So I think it probably made us less kind of more judgmental about our colleagues, which, you know, on the whole, hasn't done anything really to help women in the workplace and all the extra demands that we have to navigate. I would say as long as she's taking responsibility, phoning in, not leaving them in the lurch, bring her a cup of tea and a hot water bottle, because she'll remember that forever and you will all forget about this job because it's a part-time weekend job. But she'll remember her lovely mummy looking after her and being kind to her, won't she?
She will. And obviously, I think for Marjorie, it's triggering something inside, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Around kind of, she's probably feeling incredibly anxious that her daughter, and it's reflecting on her in some way, that her daughter, and this is all an internal conversation because it's clearly not, but it'll be happening perhaps inside Marjorie, but it's not your job, Marjorie, it's her job. It's her problem and she should be fixing it herself. It's her failure, basically, and she should be allowed to fail. And we've talked about teenagers and failure, haven't we, on the podcast last week with Elizabeth Day. It might be worth finding out what's going on. Is there something making her anxious about going to this particular job? Because your need to sort of get there and do it and be there every time, no matter what, even if your head's fallen off, is not the way she works. But maybe there's something going on underneath, you know, that conversation you're having internally means you haven't noticed something else that might be happening with her. No, it's not your, not blaming you. That just might be you just don't see it. So why has she called in three times? What else is she doing when she's, you know, what is she, what is her need on the day she doesn't go to work? I think that's worth looking at as well. It's, I just think she should be allowed, as we've said, to fail herself and deal with it herself.
Yes. What does Millie think, though?
Millie Tant says, you can do hard things. Millie Tant says, this is from the, From one of my gurus who I love, the author Glennon Doyle, you can do hard stuff. So I don't really agree with that. Oh, I don't even think Millie would agree with that slightly boomer generation. I had to do it, so you have to do it too. But I think she might be a little bit more, you can do hard things. How are you going to do it? Maybe you need to get out the door. And perhaps if you don't.
This is then, the daughter. This is the daughter needs to do it.
Maybe some shower privileges or some other privileges of living at home with mum and dad might be withdrawal. Removed if you don't test out the hard things theory.
Right.
What's Marion saying?
Well, Marion obviously wholeheartedly approves of the ranting. And she says she would also add in several hours of seething and harumphing around the house for good measure, because obviously that's going to make everyone feel a whole lot better, isn't it? I think. Thanks for that, Marion. Very helpful.
Thanks, Marion. Right, what's next up?
We have Claire. Should we do it now? Do you know? Go on.
They're all agony aunts, aren't they? Virginia Ironside. Marjorie Proops. I know Marjorie Proops. I knew Marjorie Proops. Can I tell you my Marjorie Proops story? So I started at the Daily Mirror when I was 19. I started doing shifts. One year I had to help Marjorie go through her, a bride was winning her wedding being paid for. Yes. And they were being interviewed, the engaged couple, before they got married. And you had to, Marjorie was going to pick the winner, but I had to sit next to her.
Oh, and help her.
And help her do it. Yeah, what a little privilege that was.
Do you remember who you picked? They might be listening.
We picked a couple that argued because Marjorie said to me, if anyone says in their letter, we never argue, discard them immediately because only healthy relationships have arguing. There's no point if you do agree. Yeah, they were very young, though. I do remember thinking, God, they're not much older than me, and I'm only about 19.
Well, they might be listening. We're going to have to find that out. Do some research.
Anyway, right. head on.
Finally, we have Claire, who says, I can't stop comparing myself to my friends. I stepped back from a high-flying career a few years ago because of stress, and I now work part-time in a totally different field, which has allowed me, for the first time ever, to be around for my children. My husband and I agreed we were both okay with cutting back our spending because I was always the major breadwinner, and on the whole, I'm happy with my new life. But my friend's job seemed to go from strength to strength, with promotions, bigger salaries, and opportunities to travel abroad. When we meet, I no longer talk about my job, as it just doesn't have the same status as theirs, and afterwards I always think that maybe I should get back on the corporate ladder, but have I left it too late? How do I work out what I really want to do and stop being envious of other women?
This is a common one, isn't it? Comes up a lot. I look at what they're doing and I think I should be doing that too. And also you can feel a little bit less relevant and invisible as you age. But this, dear Claire, is a conversation inside your own head.
Yes.
So this is what Julia Samuel called on our podcast, the shitty committee inside your own head. It's kind of ganging up on you. So you need to reframe the conversation. So Philippa Perry, I remember her telling us that when you feel this envy, it's a good thing because it's alerting you to the things you might want to do. So it's putting that in front of you. So it's giving you something to think about. So things you might want to do, not think about the other people doing it. So that's what envy can do. But emotions are not facts. So the outer world that they're going through is nothing to do with the inner world and the conversation you're having. So you see it from a positive point of view. I am alerted to, I might want to do this. I might want some change. I'm going to look at my life. I'm not going to think about other people. It's not really reality. And I think you also need to look at where that feeling comes from. I mean, I've talked about this before. I'm not particularly bothered what other people are doing. It's just because I think as a child or an early teenager, I spent a lot of time in my own head getting to grips with all my thoughts around myself and ignoring them if they weren't useful. So putting it to one side, but it clearly makes Claire feel very uncomfortable. So it's probably worth looking back in time to wonder why these feelings make her not feel not so valuable, why they make her feel particularly uncomfortable, but to sit with them a bit and then learn how to put them to one side and move on. What say you, Trish?
Well, I like your advice there. I think that's very helpful. I mean, I would say that Claire's made a life choice based on what she and her family needs. And she'd gone into it with her eyes wide open about the practicalities, you know, planning around money, and sounds like she's comfortable with all that. And that's both brave and to be admired, I think. And I bet her friends really admire her for that and think so too. But what she probably couldn't know or couldn't predict it, how could you, is that how losing a job, the status, the perks would make you feel on an emotional level, which is obviously what you've been talking about, and how you understand those emotions, grieve that job, grieve that part of your life. You know, so there's kind of, you know, time to process that, process the feelings. And, you know, if she's regretting her choices, regret also is a good opportunity, isn't it, to kind of learn more about yourself and what you want from your life and your career. And if she's thinking about, do I want to get back on the corporate career ladder? Have I left it too late? It's probably worth taking a moment to think that it's not so much career ladder now, is it? It's a career pathway, because people sort of go left, they go right. There isn't that traditional, you've got to be doing this for 10 years. So she could look at her network. She could look at companies that she thinks she might like to work in. She could look at kind of jobs that she might be able to kind of spin off into. And if that leaves her feeling excited and, oh, yes, then go for it. But if it doesn't, and you think, oh, my God, no stress. If your stress buzzers go off. And then I think with your friends, if you've stopped talking about work, it might be that they might need to talk about work and offload about work, and they might need support, because despite all the expense counts and health insurance perks and whatever else, they might be thinking the grass is greener, and you know, their shitty committee might be going at it in their heads saying, oh, you've got to do what Claire did, you know. And so we all have our things going on, don't we? So I think it's working out, do you really regret this decision? And working out how to kind of move forwards with your friends and just put that to one side.
I think she probably doesn't regret it. But Millie,
should we get the evil twins in? What have they got to say?
Millie says, for God's sake, woman, get a grip. No one's looking at you. Just get on with it.
Right.
That's what she says.
Okay.
What's Marion say?
Well, I think Marion's saying you're not judging your friends as much as you should be, because instead of working out what you really want from life, you should be spending your time looking at others and focusing on all the wrong stuff that they're doing.
All their failures.
All their failures, because that's going to make you feel a whole lot better about the situation. Or you could just dump the lot of them and find some new friends whose jobs and life are less successful than yours. Maybe that's the route to go.
Thank you,
Marion.
Very much, Marion. And on that note, we are now going to move to a very jolly, positive lady who is neither Marion nor Millie, or probably a little bit even nicer than us, Trish, and more upbeat.
So.
We're going to interview the very funny Angie Lamar.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Every now and then, we like to present you with a midlife woman whose uplifting and charismatic take on life is so upbeat it's positively contagious, which is what we're about to do today when we welcome comedian, actor, producer, author, broadcaster, screenwriter, playwright and campaigner Angie Lamar to the show. The 57-year-old mum of three made history when she was the first black British comedian to appear live at the legendary Harlem Apollo in New York. In an entertainment career spanning 3 decades, Angie has been a pivotal voice championing black women in comedy and beyond. From her 1994 play Funny Black Women on the Edge to her Choice FM radio show The Ladies' Room, she has been a game changer. In between stand-up shows and her work mentoring young people, Angie once deployed her chutzpah to turn a 15-minute chat slot with Whoopi Goldberg into an hour-long interview. Her adventures in show business are chronicled in her book Full Circle, Turning Your Gift Around, and Angie's accomplishments are even greater when you consider she was diagnosed as being severely dyslexic after she left school. She had her first child at 22, just as her comedy career began, and she's been married to Dave Prosper for 36 years. They have 2 sons and a daughter aged 35, 28 and 23. Comedian Mo Gilligan credits Angie as one of his biggest career inspirations, and she performed last year on stage with him at the O2 in front of 20,000 people. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Angie.
Hi, I'm really glad to be here.
Right, well, I have to admit that when we had our little briefing phone call a few weeks ago before you came on the show, I had a bit of a girl crush on you because I had a spring in my step all day after our chat. You've been through quite a lot in the past few years, but before we dive in and talk about all of that, you are speaking to us today from Jamaica because you're back home with your mum, Olive, aren't you? Where are you? What's going on?
Yeah, I'm in Maypay in Clarendon. I kind of live in Jamaica and live in England, but as my mum is getting older and kind of, you know, more frail, I find myself here. So I'll be here till May, but I'll gauge her at that point and then decide if I just extend it.
Let's go back to the beginning, because obviously Olive, she was first generation immigrants to the UK, is that right, with your dad? And you grew up in Southeast London. Tell us about what it was like at that time in the 70s, growing up, and how it was for you at school.
I had quite a wonderful childhood, to be quite honest. I grew up with Pentecostal parents. My parents are Christians, and so I grew up in the church. It was very much a family growing up, you know, like I've got 4 older brothers. For me, it was a really a great family setting. My parents came from Jamaica with great family values, which is very much, you know, family is important, our religion is important, keeping a family together is important. And even though my parents had gone through difficult times and had a lot of things, you know, challenging them, I realised that they were fighters.
But Angie, you went to school in Lewisham, didn't yeah. you? And you were very rebellious at school and you were expelled. But it wasn't till you left school that you were diagnosed as severely dyslexic. And a lot of your rebellion at school was around you being really vocal about the racism you were experiencing at school. So you then went into the entertainment world, but you must have formed your personality at that time. What kind of traits do you think formed that took you forward into the entertainment world with no education?
Being at school and trying to explain to your parents at that in that generation that your teachers don't like you and you know it's because you're black, because who feels it knows it? At that point, you just think, I don't think you did the same to me that you did to her. That doesn't feel fair. And you try to explain it, but everybody pushes you down. But there's a part of my spirit, I probably get it from my parents, coming from Jamaica, which was, you know, that's actually wrong, miss. That's wrong, sir. I don't think you should say that. That's not very nice, because that's not what my mum and dad would say to me at home. And then I had the humorous side, which was I'd crack jokes. So my way of getting out of things was to crack a joke. So if I felt embarrassed by the teachers, or I felt upset or feeling like I needed to pull that strength in, my thing was jokes. I told jokes. I got laughs. And when you hear a laugh and you think, I created that, that's a real big thing. So friends came to me to worry about the bully. So if somebody was getting bullied, they'd come to me and I'd be the one that'd walk up to people and say, you can't do that. You're not going to do that to my friends. So I was this person that always stood up. And I think it's because I had older brothers who taught me how to fight. That I think I traveled into the entertainment business and especially into stand-up. I think I'm so fearless that it used to scare me. I was just like, I don't care what you think about me. And it hasn't let me down. You know, I haven't felt like I care what people think. I care if you don't laugh, because that's my job. And I'm working hard to do that. But I've worked out in school that I can make people laugh. So I trust that. I make my family laugh. I trust that. And that's all I did, was trust what I went through. And when I was at school, I was quite rebellious. And then I got kicked out of school because they saw me as problematic, you know, always outside the headmistress's office. And she'd come and say, Angie, what are you doing out here? And I'd say, well, what are you doing out here? You know, I thought that was funny, but no, it wasn't.
How did your parents respond to that? Because my parents were Irish immigrant parents. We grew up in the Catholic Church in North London. Yeah. And it was, everything was, you had to behave properly. You had to, you know, and school was so much about discipline, wasn't it? And, you know, being seen and not heard and all of that. Did your parents support you? How did they?
Well, at the beginning, they had no idea. I mean, they sent this little angel to school. Mm-hmm. And it was like she went off and her socks was up here and they didn't know I had trousers underneath my skirt, you know. And I was like, bye, mum, bye, dad. So when they did find out about the reports on the school parents' evening, my parents used to look at me like, who are you? And I used to think, I don't know. I don't know what happens to me when I come to school. Mum, it's them. They're doing this to me. So as a performer, I love performing. And when they were in my drama class, they were like, she's an angel here, but a little devil over here. What is going on? It was then that my mum realised, you like the arts, you like acting. So I started to go to drama clubs and she just saw me blossom.
That's brilliant, isn't it? For parents, you've just got to find your kids their wow, isn't it? What they really love and what they're good at, I think.
We've had quite a few comedians on the show, and we had Arabella Weir and Angela Barnes. And one of the things they've told us is that it was quite tough to be a woman in stand-up, particularly earlier for this generation as they were going through, because women then just weren't seen funny and they just weren't given the breaks. Now, you were a woman in stand-up and you were on stage in London, but you're also a black woman. So it must have been really tough for you. What keeps you going and what situations did you navigate? Because you've got quite a lot of grace and elegance around how you deal with everything, I know from our chats. But what's in you that made it work? Because you were the first British stand-up comedian at the famous Harlem Apollo, weren't you? Yeah. So how did you get to that point? I mean, it must have been quite hard work.
First of all, stand-up comedy is hard work. And then it's difficult for women because of the way men treat us. They treat us like, oh, we've got a woman on the bill. for all you ladies out there that want to giggle, you know.
It was makes me very cross, Angie.
Yeah, yeah. It was almost like you're trying to fight through this whole myth of I'm funny, because I'm Britain's first black female. So when I came on, if they wanted a woman and a black person, I was literally two for one. I get the bookings based on, well, we've ticked both boxes. For me, sometimes the mainstream circuit was a bit difficult because it was trying to understand what you think of me and what I think of you and how the two come together. Because when I play a black audience, I'm straight in. Whereas when I was playing the main street and like the working men club, like sometimes I'd walk into a club, the whole place would be silent, like, oh dear. And I'd think, I can't make this audience laugh. This is going to be a nightmare. And then you walk on stage and go, funny is funny. I got to get my story across to you and make you laugh. What made it easier for me? This is why a lot of women drop out, because children come in and travel is difficult, because somebody will call you and say, you've got to get to Hull tonight. And you're thinking, how do I get to Hull? Do I stay over? Because if I stay over, that hotel fee is going to be quite expensive and that's half the money gone. So will I get back the same night? But what really cut that out for me was my husband, my boyfriend at the time, who's my husband now. He loved driving. So I'd phone him up and say, Dave, I've got a gig in wherever. And he'd be like, all right, I'll finish work and then we'll drive up. Then when we had children, we used to put the kids in the car. So I promised them McDonald's on the way home, do my gig, jump in the car and drive back home. So that's where a lot of women used to drop out, because it was that travel, that safety. It's a hard road. It's difficult.
Let me talk about your material, because I've been watching some very funny clips, and it strikes me that we have a little segment on this show called Nostalgia Noodle, where we look back to sort of things from the 70s and 80s. And, you know, I was watching a very funny clip earlier about you having seen Roots for the first time on TV, going into school and talking about it. So is a lot of your material based on your experiences as a kind of Gen X woman who's grown up in those times?
Absolutely. You know, the first rule of comedy for me was write what you know, tell your story and put your funny in that. And I find everything funny. You know, some in the worst place, people go, Angie, you really would find a joke there? Absolutely, I would. You know, and so when I remember watching Roots and thinking, damn, these white people are terrible. How are we going to go to school the next day? So we go to school the next day and I'm looking at all my friends who are my best friends, black and white, and all the black girls are looking at each other like, get over here. We've got to get away from them, you know. Your friends will be going, are you not playing out? And I'm like, no, I saw Roots. And in my head, that's funny. After a while, you start to trust yourself and go, here's my line. You know, I know when I'm over the line. And it's nice to go over the line and get out, ooh, you're not going there, Angie. And you think, ooh, yes, I am.
Yeah. What about being a woman in midlife?
What is great is that my audience have followed me through my whole life, like my children, and they know all my kids' names and stuff. So when I was going through midlife crisis, not crisis, going through my hormonal changes, as they say, I'd question the audience, because I'd be sweating on stage thinking, I've only been on 10 minutes. I haven't worked. Why am I gushing? Sometimes ladies would walk up and hand me a tissue like, you go, Ange. And I weren't getting the hint at that point. I was like, I know, these lights are really hot. And then it started to dawn on me that you're getting on, love. This is what's happening. You know what I mean? You feel young and cute, but your body's saying, we're still this age, darling. So at that point, my body started to change and my audience started to come with me on that. Even when I had my hysterectomy, people always like to keep their stories quiet. And I thought, no, I've got to talk about it, because I've spoken about everything else. This is something I want to share. And because my audience is my age as well, they look like me, they feel like me, they're my age group, they are going through it too. And they want me to do the funny side of it.
So you're 57 now, and you went through the perimenopause in your 40s. But what did you go through that led up to you having a hysterectomy? Because you had other gynecological issues, didn't you? And it really affected your mental health, didn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's something that you know, having really heavy periods and then finding out that thing that everyone's talking about, which is fibroids, is something that you've got. And then my periods were just so bad, like you couldn't move. I couldn't move for the fact that it was very heavy. And then I couldn't move for the fact that I was in pain. Then there was this cloud that was coming over my head. I stopped doing performance for a while and started to write and direct and produce because I felt safer there. I felt like I could just be the person over here. I didn't have to be the performer, which takes another energy from you. And at that point, I just thought, well, maybe it's over for me. Maybe I'll just become this quiet writer that's retired in the Caribbean and gets her glasses out and eats lots of vegetables. I saw myself like that. And I was trying to explain to my kids that I'm changing. I don't feel like that. My friends were changing. I didn't want to go out. I didn't want to party. I didn't want to go to events anymore because your body changes. You're always protecting yourself and protecting, especially if you're flowing and you're thinking, I can't stand up because everything's going to gush out. And it just felt horrible. So I stopped. And then when I went back to the doctors, that's when they said to me, your fibroids are, because I was getting big, but I was getting big in one way. Couldn't do my shoes up. It was like, I feel like I'm pregnant. But the size of my fibroids were over, you know, 6 month pregnancy. They said I have a full hysterectomy. And I thought, well, can't I keep some bits so that I can still have my periods or I can still do.
Quite emotional, isn't it, to have a hysterectomy? It's not just sort of, you know, a medical treatment. It's a kind of end of that part of your life, isn't it?
I don't know what I felt. I know I felt relieved because I remember doing up my shoe thinking, oh, my God, I was expecting this big weight loss. Like, now that I've had this hysterectomy, I can't believe how skinny I'm going to be now. And then I realised nothing. It's just my stomach was a little flatter and that was it. But it was just the sadness afterwards of the healing process and feeling like I don't have certain things in my body. My body's changing and my body's not supporting me anymore. So that's when I went back to the doctors and they put me on HRT and I was like, okay, feeling a bit better now. Mm-hmm. And I remember I hadn't done stand-up for years. I was more performing and writing and directing. And I really had written off stand-up because I thought, I won't remember because I couldn't remember things. So I was thinking, my memory is the bit that worries me because I've got to stand on stage and remember an hour and a half of material. If I can't remember that, then I'm finished. Mm-hmm. And then once I started on HRT, I started to feel like, oh my God.
You've got your mojo back.
It was quite a nice little place, isn't it? You know.
When you had your hysterectomy, did they talk you through you're going to go into a menopause, you can have HRT? It's like you have to go cold turkey and lose all those hormones. Did they offer you HRT? Did they talk to you about that?
Not at all. I think when I left the hospital, it was very much like go and see your doctor and take it from there. But I was so busy in the healing because on the surgery that I had, it opened up again and I went back into hospital.
Oh, gosh.
And the thing is, when you talk to your friends, there's one who doesn't need HRT and there's one who wouldn't live without it. There's one who healed after and was jogging around the park after 4 weeks. And there's one who's 4 years and still isn't really recovered. So as much as you're getting all this advice and you're reading all the information, it really is personal and you've just got to listen to your body. And feel your way through it. Like, I don't feel great. Do I feel this cloud over my head? If I'm such a positive person, this cloud doesn't sound like me. So something's not right.
But you've been actually very pivotal in campaigning for the representation of Black women in all the kind of literature around gynecological problems and cancers and things. But this must have been a tougher thing. I mean, we're all expected to endure this anyway as women, and we know 2/3 of women are just fobbed off with antidepressants from their GPs. But how did you begin to look around you and think, but hold on a minute, there are no Black women in this conversation around menopause? I mean, there isn't much. It's only the last year or so that women have been talked about. What was your thinking around that?
I think because I used to do so much work in the community, radio shows and stuff like that, I was always fighting for somebody. It's so easy. I spoke about it when I was at school. I could fight for somebody. But then when you have to fight for yourself, it means putting yourself out there saying, actually, I've got this too, or I'm suffering from this too. I remember back in the 80s, we fought for more Black women to be recognized for checking their breast and having imagery on black women in those pamphlets. Because growing up, my mum and that generation didn't think breast cancer was something that they needed to worry about. On their leaflets, it looks like middle-class white women suffered from that. So we campaigned for that. Hysterectomies or menopause is something that we're all trying to be vocal about because now that generation is older and now they're saying, well, we've got radios, we've got campaigns, we've got brands. We can actually speak about it. and be okay about saying that this is our age. I'm not scared of telling people my age. I'm very proud that I've got to this age, as opposed to, I know some friends who don't like to talk about their age. They just want to be, and they're actors, and I understand they don't want to have that issue around casting. But there comes a point when you have to say, look, I'm 57, that's what it is. So therefore, I'm going through this. If I can speak out about it, and there are a few other Black women who have started up the Black Menopause and, you know, having that discussion, it's fantastic, because I know my mum didn't have that. All I know is that she was very hot, and that was it.
Just take you back a little bit to your career. So you have three children, and you had your first child at 22, didn't you? It was a bit of a surprise. And as you got more and more successful, you were offered some work in America, weren't you? But you had to turn it down, didn't you? Because you decided you wanted to be at home. Tell us about that, where we could have seen you on the screens, and because it was quite a big role that you were asked to go and talk about, isn't it?
Yeah, I think for me, it was like at that point where Black female comedians were growing, I went over to America and doors were opening, like auditioning for the Cosby Show, having a reading, and then playing the Apollo. And these were just, because like I say, I walk up to anything and say, can I have? My brother always said to me, they're either going to say yes or no. Chill out. So I remember going to the Apollo and saying, look, I know that Chuck Sutton runs the Apollo. I'd like to play the Apollo. And they came down with security because they probably thought, where is this British woman coming from? A bit off key. So I'm there saying, look, it's been my dream to play the Apollo. Can I play the Apollo? And he looked at me and went, well, you're going to be my special guest tomorrow. And I was, wow, thank you. And so I went through America like that and contacted the Cosby Show and said to them, I pretended to be an agent, my agent, saying, hi, Angie's in town. She's only seen a few people. She'd like to see you. And they were like, sure, tell us more. So I went to see them, did a reading. And then they said to me, something's coming up, which is a different world. And we think that you'll be really ideal for some roles that could be coming up. And I remember doing, do you remember Video Diaries?
BBC one.
That's right. So all that was being filmed was Video Diary. They had me there for like 10 weeks. And so I had to stay in New York for this audition, but I was also booked to go to LA to finish his documentary. So that's when I had to make that decision to say, well, I believe that this documentary that I'm making is actually going to be bigger than the role that you're going to offer me. So I'm going to go with this documentary because that's actually what I'm supposed to be doing. But thank you anyway. Only to come back to England, and they said that they felt that the documentary didn't have any balance, like it was too positive. There was no crying in the alley, like, oh my God, I died on stage. It was like, guess who I met? Guess who I met? It was too up.
You've always been good at asking, haven't you, people? Because I remember it mentions in your book that Whoopi Goldberg, you were offered an interview and they said, you've got 15 minutes with Whoopi, don't keep her any longer. Yes. You had an hour and a half in the end, didn't you?
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, I got to Whoopi's heart. You know, she came into Planet Hollywood and I was like, okay, Whoopi, I've got 15 minutes with you. Can I just be reading your book, be at the bar, and you come over to me and go, hey, Angie. And I look at the book and I go, and you say... She looked at me and the agent gave me a look that to this day, it was so piercing. And I remember looking at the agent thinking, oh, one chance. And if I was met somebody who was inspired by me and they did that to me, I'd be giving them all the time. So Whoopi saw that in me and she was like, okay. And then her agent kept saying, hey, Whoopi. And she went, don't worry about it.
And you've met some other and interviewed other amazing celebrities. There's a very good Stevie Wonder story that we love.
Stevie Wonder, honestly, when you're talking to Stevie Wonder, now I'm on Choice FM, I've got number one radio show Saturday morning, and everybody wants to get on the show. So when you get Stevie Wonder, but you've got to go to Stevie's event, and you walk in and he looks up. I say looks up because I know he's blind.
Yeah.
You feel like he's looking at you because he's talking to you like, I'm thinking, are you sure you're blind? Like, can you see shapes? You know when you want to talk like that to somebody, but you know he's absolutely. And then we're talking and he's just talking to me and talking about his music. Now I'm a big fan, so I can go into the history of his music. And then I said to him, it's my birthday. And to my surprise, Stevie Wonder went, happy birthday, Andy. Happy.
Not many people can say that. That's Stevie right. Wonder sung happy birthday to them.
And then he finished it off with, you know, and you didn't bring me no cake. And I'm thinking, Why didn't I bring cake?
Do you think he thinks everyone says that to him so that they can say that? But you were genuine.
I was absolutely genuine. And, you know, the security, I've got a thing for security. Like I can get past any security. I don't know what it is. It's just that I have this thing that I look at them like, I could be your sister, your wife, your, I need your help to get me into that room. And no matter what, they just go, come on.
That is a skill to have. Now, you had quite a sort of, well, you talked about it, a bit of a tough time in lockdown. And because you're you and you decided to help other people out at the same time, you noticed other people were a bit lonely in lockdown. And yeah. You began this thing called We Walk Wednesday, which is sort of one of the ways I found you on Instagram when I started to follow you. And that was gathering people together on their own voluntarily to just go for a walk. And it was really predominantly gathering Black women, women of colour together. And then you got people to come along and do a bit of mentoring, and you got people to chat. And it's now kind of sort of blossomed, hasn't it? It sort of covers the country. What, tell us a little bit about We Walk Wednesday and how people can be involved.
For me, I've got a dog. I've got my little chocolate Labrador. And, you know, one thing about dogs, you will walk any day, any weather, you've got to go regardless. So for me, walking is such a, it's so relaxing, it's great for my mental health, and I just love meeting people. So my park is a great park, Hillyfields Park. And I remember I was talking to a friend of mine who's a comedian who lives in the same area. He has a dog, had a dog, but he doesn't, but he keeps the walks up with me. And I remember thinking, lockdown, what could we do? Maybe there's some people who would like to walk who don't have a dog. Maybe a few people would like to walk. So I went on my Facebook and said, anybody want to walk on Wednesday, Hillyfields Park, 7 o'clock, you know, a little stroll if you need company. Now I'm thinking, no one's going to come out. So I'm standing at the place where I said to meet, and I see about 20 women walking from there, 10, 15, 20, 30, just walking towards me. And I'm thinking, where are they going? And I said to my daughter, oh my God, they think I'm fit.
Oh, they think you're going to take them on a kind of...
Yeah, this, let's go. I was talking like a stroll. So they get in front of me, and my daughter, she's quite fit. And I said to her, can you do some stretches? Do some stretches. You've got to do stretches. You've got to do something. She's like, Mum, I don't do that. I said, look, just stretch and bow. And everyone's looking at me. I'm like, yeah, let's just march on the spot. And we just stretch. And we're just making it up because we don't know what we're doing, because we weren't expecting that. I really was expecting about 4 or 5 people. Mm-hmm. And then I do laughter therapy. So I thought, I tell you what, I'll add something to it. Ha, 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 hee, 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 ho, ho, let's do some laughter. Let's get the body excited. And on the Monday, I had met this guy that was riding around on his bike playing soul music. So I said to him, well, I'm going to do a little walk on. Why don't you come round? And I was literally just saying that. He comes over the hill playing Forget Me Not. And the whole park is dancing. And when he joins me, I'm like, that's right, we've got Keep Fit, we've got a little bit of music and laughter therapy, let's walk. And that was it. And every week, and then other people said, can you come to our park? So I said, well, I can't come to your park, but if you'd be an ambassador, I'll get some T-shirts made up. So we were doing it on the fly, get a website and everything, and just built it. Now we've got 20 parks.
We often talk about women in midlife, their careers can get a bit wobbly. We don't know where we're going. We might kind of get made redundant. Did you ever imagine where your career might go and the opportunities that would come from one thing and another and another?
I knew that I'd always wanted to perform. But what I didn't know, especially coming out of school when I had to go back to get my education, go back to learn how to do things that I didn't get at school, I actually thought, actually, you're quite intelligent, Angie. You really are, you know. And so you can take up this pen and write and enjoy it. So as I've gone through life, things have come up and I've gone, I'll give that a go. I don't mind doing that. You know, and we used to be taught jack of all trades, master of none, which is a lie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we master so many things, especially as mothers as well. You master negotiation, you master how to be diplomatic. You master so many things that if you've got the confidence to start something new and say, well, I'm going to try this, I'm going to go and live in Jamaica, actually. I definitely know I'm going to die. And I know that my funeral must be packed. And I said to my kids, put sold out. Do you know what I mean? to the end, I'm bringing in the number.
Oh, love it.
And know that I lived a great life.
we can't all be Angie with this amazing positivity. But if you're in midlife, women come unstuck. They unravel a little bit. Lots of women do. And that's part of the reason we set up the podcast. What would your advice be to a woman who's in her 40s now? It's all a bit wobbly. She's lost her confidence. She can't remember anything. So her mojo's gone. She doesn't even know she can do her job properly. She's got a lot of responsibilities. What's your advice, the simple things that women could do to kind of feel like you do about that situation? Because you've been through it now.
One of the biggest things I say to people is go and learn something new with new people who don't know you. We go through life carrying the same people with us who know our story, and we don't get to share or reinvent ourselves because they, I know you. You don't want to do that. You know, they give you that type of feedback. Whereas if you go to a new place and remember the child in the teens, that child, speak to that child and say, what did you used to want to do? You wanted to paint, right? You wanted to do this, right? Remember you can't swim, but you really want to swim? Go and learn how to do those things, because then you'll meet people around on their journey who don't know who you are. So you can be who you want to be, and they will encourage that. So I'll always say to people, go and learn something new.
So before we let you go into the glorious Jamaican sunshine, Angie, we'd love to know about the time you met Maya Angelou, because obviously she's a hero for women worldwide, and it's possibly going to be the biggest name drop. Lorraine likes to name drop on the show, but I think this might out name drop all name Maya. Drops.
When I walked into the room, it was like there was a light around her. I'm telling you, it was like, hi. And I went over and shook her hand, and I tilted my head like, pleased to meet you. And she just went, never bow. Don't bow to anybody but God. And I was like, oh, you're Maya Angelou. So
you're quite close to God here. Yeah.
You're kind of God-ish.
We can pick a God.
Yeah. It will be you. So, and I remember sitting there thinking, this woman is so amazing. Everything she says. And I remember asking her about her faith and said, you're a Christian. And she goes, oh, I work on being a Christian every day. There's every day new challenges. And I take that away, because every day there's a new challenge. Like you wake up and you think, how am I going to get through this day? What of yesterday didn't really work that I don't want to repeat? And she was just this woman that was given such sound advice that you forget you're interviewing her. You just let her talk. It's almost rude to ask her a question. It's like, you speak, we'll just record.
What next then? You're writing children's book. Are you writing a movie as well? Do we see you doing any more stand-up? Because you did stand-up last year, I think, or the year before with Mo Gilligan, didn't you?
Yeah, so Mo Gilligan has gone and, given us life, the older generation, people who inspired him. So that was really great, walking onto the O2, 20,000 people. I'm thinking, oh, big gig. And that was great. So I will get up to do some more stand-up. I probably want to tour next year. I'm writing a movie, two movies. So it's writing movies and just really being here for my mom and just enjoying life.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on Postcards from Midlife.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
Well, I have to say, it's all been about meeting your childhood heroes today. Angie Lamar got Maya Angelou. I got Glenn Hoddle. It's quite exciting. All very noodly, though. All very nostalgic.
Slightly more inspired by Angie, but...
Yeah, I know. But listen, nostalgia noodle. You had an idea for this, didn't you? Because we're sort of running out of ideas because we've done so many of them.
To keep thinking
about. Go on, you go first.
What inspired me is I've been doing a bit of work with schools, and I was just thinking about this massive kind of pressure kids get to university or further education. But actually at the minute, there's a massive drive for apprenticeships. So a lot of kids are being offered, straight into work, get going. Now, that's how I started, left school at 16, straight into work. So I was thinking we could noodle back to our first day in our kind of either apprenticeships or our first proper work day. Because obviously my daughter's doing this now being a mechanical engineer in Norwich for a jet engine building company. So we're going through all of that with her. So I went back to when I had my first day at the Cornish Times, 1872. And I was thinking, what did I wear on my first day? And then I was remembering, Trish, it brought back another little noodle. Do you remember the catalogues, the Littlewood catalogues, all the little catalogues?
Oh, yes.
So in prep for my first proper day, I thought I need to look as adult as possible because I was so young. I was only 16. So I got myself a little grey skirt from the catalogue. And there was such and a little fluffy blue mohair jumper. And there was such anticipation, wasn't there? Because you ordered it and then you had to wait weeks for it to arrive.
And then you were paying it off week by week, weren't you?
And then you were still paying it off. Yes. So what you wore to work was really important because it often took ages and cost ages as well. Yeah, no, so that took me back. And a little pair of mild height heels. So I guess you'd call it kitten height, little pair of grey heels.
A kitten heel. And look where it all led. Look where it all led.
Yes, look where
the Cornish Times. I shouldn't say it like that, should I?
You can't do Cornish accents. No, I can't. Oh, I can.
I've had so many jobs before I got the job that started. So I don't think we need to do the care home or McDonald's or any of those, do we? That's not what you're talking about. Okay, so my first proper job was doing advertising production on something called LA Week.
Right.
Now, what do you think LA Week was about?
It's not Los Angeles, is it?
It certainly wasn't.
Loose ankles?
Local authority. Actually, it might have been LA News. Local authority news.
Got to start somewhere, Trish. Got to start somewhere.
And I used to do all the little classified advertisements and sort of weird stuff at the back. I used to produce all of that with the old typesetting. There wasn't even desktop publishing back in those olden days. And you know what was really awful? My first day on the job, I can't remember what I wore, but what I do remember is sitting on this bank of desks and the man opposite me smoked cigars all day long.
Oh.
Because you could smoke in offices back in those days. And I thought, oh my God, am I going to be able to stay in this job? This is my career. It's taking off. I'm on Local Authority Week. And a cigar nearly put paid to it all.
You know what Millie would have done, wouldn't you? Don't you?
Oh, gosh.
She would have taken it and stubbed it out on his hand.
Yes, on his hand.
Here we are at the end of Postcards from Midlife. Thank you very much for listening. As you know, new episodes are available. Really helpful if you press the download and subscribe, because then we automatically drop into your inbox. If you want to meet us, this is a very exciting opportunity for people who would like to come into the room and have all their midlife questions answered, not just by us, but proper experts. Meet all our celebrity guests. We are having a live two-day festival in May on the 19th and 20th. It's going to be brilliant. There'll be shopping and champagne and cake as well. Trish, how do we get tickets for it?
Well, all you have to do is go to this website, postcardsfrommidlifelive.co.uk.
Exciting. Tell all your friends about us. Tell them about the show. Tell them about the live. And if you want to have a further engagement with us, this is just, we offer everything, don't we?
Oh, my God. Yeah, nonstop.
Pop over to our private Facebook group. Become a member. You have to answer 3 questions and agree to abide by Trish's rules. And you can join in the chat there. We are on the Facebook all the time, so we are trying to drop in and answer questions and put up helpful resources. So thank you for listening, and it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
It's a new ending, Trish.